Hello. This week we revisit some of our favourite features from recent shows, including a conversation with pianist Elaine Grimaud.
It's only a matter of putting 100% of who you are into what you do in the moment.
In light of a bleak report on non-profit theatre in the United States, Jason Pfeiffer examines the health of Philadelphia's theatre companies. Albert Stumm takes a look at the state of arts education in our public schools. We visit the Philadelphia Sketch Club, the oldest artist-run organization in the country. And in our regular dip into the Culture File section at gophilla.com, Susan Lewis tours Fireman's Hall, the nation's first fire company founded by Benjamin Franklin. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Elaine Grimaud wowed audiences at the Kimmel Center recently with a series of performances with the Philadelphia Orchestra of one of her signature pieces, Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. Since she began playing in U.S. venues in 1990, Grimaud has made a name for herself not only for her piano-playing prowess, but also for her single-minded dedication to living her life by her own rules. I met with her backstage before one of her Kimmel performances where she debunked one of the great misconceptions about classical music.
I think that the tragedy with classical music is people think if they don't have a background in the matter, if they aren't educated, that it's not for them. And of course, there's nothing less true than that. All you have to do is to have the ability to feel, which of course everyone does. And so if you allow yourself to feel, the only thing you have to be aware of with classical music is that it is truly needing to be interactive. You can't just sit there and hope that the stimulation that the music provides is sufficient to draw you in. I mean, the more you put from yourself into it, the more you get back.
Yeah, but then people say, oh, she's Elaine Grimaud. She's this amazing, prodigious musician, understood piano from an early age, has always got it, rehearses in her head. It's easy for her.
No, but no, it really isn't. You see, it's not easy for me, and it's not any easier than it would be for anyone else. Because, again, it's only a matter of putting 100% of who you are into what you do in the moment. That means really giving it proper attention, because one of the problems these days is we're so constantly over-solicited, over-stimulated with a bunch of things that you tend to do things in automatic pilot mode, and then you don't actually connect with the essence of what you're dealing with, and that's, of course, the worst. So if you can be in this sort of zen-like conception
committed
of the moment.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Where there's nothing before, there's nothing after. This is all you've got now, and you make the most of it now. Then, it's the diversity, the range of emotions that classical music can provide is really unequaled. And this is not coming from someone who is intolerant and doesn't like any other types of music. There's no term to listen to all kinds of things.
A certain peace does come with that ability to commit to the moment and just live in the moment and not think about what's happening in other aspects of your life or what's going to happen in 10 minutes. That's something you had from a very, very early age, that you could almost be obsessional about things from a very early age. Was that a good thing? Do you think that made your life easier, or did it make it more peaceful at an early age to be able to be so focused on one thing at a time?
Well, it made my life better when I was dealing with the appropriate substance to be letting this trait of temperament exercise itself. Before that, it wasn't so good because I was extremely focused, but if I didn't have anything to focus on, then it would sort of turn against, me or things in my environment. But I think to be a musician, you have to be obsessive. That's what being a perfectionist is. You're never satisfied. You always have to go back at something, redo it, revisit it, dismantle it, put it back together. So I think and I don't want to say a quality because it's not necessarily a quality, but it's just an idiosyncrasy, a characteristic of temperament that is in every musician.
I was speaking to a friend of mine about you who's interviewed you in the past, and he said Elaine Grimaud has a great ability to get exactly what she wants without offending anybody, that you choose your own repertoire, you choose not to travel long distances or for long periods of time when you're performing. You've kind of established how you want to run your life, and if, the record company or the presenters don't understand that, well, that's fine. Is that the case?
That is true. I mean, you do make a few enemies along the way. It's inevitable. And in fact, it's almost a good sign. You'd have to be quite suspicious of yourself and of the life you're leading if you didn't make a few enemies here and there. Because that's just what goes with the territory of just being yourself. So if you don't like to compromise too much, then, of course, you're going to run into certain difficulties. But when I try to express what it is I need to do, I try to make clear that it's not against someone else. it just has to be my way. Now, it doesn't mean I'm completely not receptive to things from the outside. I mean, very often, you know, some of the best things I've done in my life have been suggested by others. But when they're suggested, I can immediately feel a resonance. And then I know that it's connecting with something inside of me. So be it that that person is perceptive enough to think, you know, you might want to think about this. And all of a sudden, when I do, I see the reason why, you know, then all of a sudden there's this logic about, oh, yes, you know, and all of a sudden I'm intrigued. And then I go down that path and there we are. So, you know, I don't want to say that anything that comes from the outside, I immediately, block out. Not at all. But so if I feel I have to do something, I try to explain that, you know, there is no guarantee of quality. But if there is only one, is that you have to at least do things in a way that are essential and vital for you. Because if artistically, if you do something, but you could just as well do something else, there's something missing.
Excerpt from Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Yuri Tymirkanov with piano soloist Alain Grimaud.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This past June, the Theater Communications Group, an advocacy organization for American professional nonprofit theaters, released its annual report on the financial health of its members. While the report offers a few bright spots, the findings aren't entirely encouraging. On a national scale, 2004 nonprofit theater attendance was at its lowest level in 5 years. While there's been an increase in theater companies operating in the black, almost half of the companies surveyed still ended 2004 in deficit. In light of these findings, Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer wondered how Philadelphia theaters in particular are faring these days. Here's his report.
There aren't a lot of official numbers to peruse, but in short, the consensus among Philadelphia theaters seems to be, we're actually doing okay. Knock on wood. There are a variety of reasons for this era of good feeling in the city of brotherly love. To understand the factors, it's helpful to go back 4 years. Sarah Goranzik, producing artistic director of Philadelphia Theater Company, says September 11 is definitely a milestone in recent audience buying trends.
But at the same time, we have to remember that was also a time that the economy sort of tanked. Since that time, patterns have shifted enormously. I think my colleagues will agree with me that nationwide, audience members will tend to make decisions more last minute and are more reluctant to subscribe and make a commitment as to where they are going to be 6 months from now.
The widespread reluctance of audiences to commit to tickets is predictably problematic for many theaters. It makes planning for future shows a tricky task. Fortunately for Philadelphia Theater Company, the shift in audience buying patterns hasn't hurt too much. Company subscriptions have taken a dive since 2001, but single ticket and group sales have dramatically shot up, adequately compensating for any lack of growth in subscriptions. While audience numbers went down for the Arden Theater Company as well in 2001, the past 2 years have been extraordinarily successful for the company. In fact, last season, the Arden had the largest attendance and subscription base that they've ever had. Almost 90,000 people came out to see Arden Productions, says the company's managing director, Amy Murphy.
I think people were getting a little more comfortable again, a little more ready to commit and go back to their regular lives.
Even though Arden ticket sales are slightly down again this season, Murphy seems confident that the company remains in good shape. Theater Alliance of Greater Philadelphia Executive Director James Haskins observes that the Philadelphia theater community in general is in a similar state.
I think there's certainly a great deal of strength in our community, and while we're seeing challenges across the country, declining subscription numbers, I think here we are somewhat bucking the trend, and I want to make certain that we continue to buck that trend and that we're not simply behind the trend.
In contrast to many other communities, Philadelphia is a relatively young theater town, which means there's probably still more room to grow and accommodate up-and-coming theaters. Aaron Lucas is artistic director of the Flashpoint Theater Company, which just started its second season. According to her, small and new companies like the Flashpoint are optimistic they can make it in Philadelphia, even as many other theaters nationwide find it difficult to stay afloat.
We were sort of surprised about the amount of money that we were able to bring in from ticket sales in our first year. It was more than we had anticipated, and it's really helped us kind of carry on into our next season. I wouldn't say we're in a real solid position, but we have a lot of potential. We have grant support that's more available to us in the next few months. And if we can sell as well as we have been, we'll be in a good place.
The combination of good ticket sales and a steady influx of grant money from the government, individuals, foundations, and corporations is crucial for the vitality of nonprofit theaters. Managing director of 1812 Productions, Kate Tobiah Tejada, is quick to credit the generosity of the Philadelphia community in helping to supply local theaters with the funding to accompany ticket sales, something she believes is not as abundant in other cities. Still, Tejada doesn't suggest donated money grows on trees, especially if it's to be earmarked for day-to-day expenses.
Securing monies for projects is actually a lot easier than securing money for the whole. General operating income is some of the most difficult money to secure because, you know, projects and plays are sexy. People want to fund that. But to make sure that we have health insurance is not, you know, very sexy. So
for 1812 Productions and every other theater company in Philadelphia, it is a constant battle to find fresh ways to reach and attract new audiences. Although James Haskins of the Theater Alliance is certainly pleased with all the success of the region's theater, he doesn't think it's reached its fullest potential.
There's still a lot of audience development out there that can be done. We have a lot out there to introduce patrons to, and I wholeheartedly believe that there truly is something for everybody in this city as far as theater experiences go.
The people of the greater Philadelphia region seem to agree with Haskins. They support well over 100 theater companies, and a handful of them have popped up just within the past few years. While many theaters across the country labor to simply sustain themselves, there are many signs that Philadelphia theater's future is hopeful.
That was Jason Pfeiffer. Up ahead, Susan Lewis heads to Fireman's Hall in Philadelphia, but first we turn to the issue of arts education in public schools. It's no secret that public schools in the United States have struggled with tight budgets and mounting financial demands in the last several years. This means arts programs have been slashed or even cut completely from many schools' curricula. The past several years have been no different for the Philadelphia School District, whose highly publicized financial woes contributed to a state takeover 3 years ago. But as WRTI's Albert Stumm reports, new money and the district's cultural partnerships may soon allow more Philadelphia students to paint, dance, and sing.
In policy discussions over the nation's public schools, education in the arts often takes a back seat to what many consider more pressing issues. Learning multiplication tables takes precedence over learning watercolors, and the ABCs are viewed as more important than the musical mnemonic device FACE. Those priorities may be valid, but putting academics first and the arts second means fewer children are exposed to the arts at all. In Philadelphia's public school system, only 50% of schools have a music teacher, let alone an entire music department, and the same goes for art teachers. Approximately 47 out of 273 schools have neither a music nor an art teacher. Philadelphia, however, is not alone. Bob Capanna, executive director of Settlement Music School, says arts programs have been disappearing for decades.
In the late 70s and through the 80s, as funding for public schools in general got tighter, and as a public sentiment got focused on reading, writing, and arithmetic, those programs tended to decline. And now in the Philadelphia public schools, there's a much more limited program.
If a child is failing to read, the parent is going to be most concerned that Johnny learns to read, because if Johnny doesn't learn to read, Johnny is unemployable.
That's Dennis Creedon, the administrator for the Philadelphia School District's Office of Creative and Performing Arts.
These are national issues, and they're being played out in small city halls and townships across the entire nation. And in every instance, people are being forced to make unbelievable difficult decisions. It's almost like Solomon and the baby. How do you decide what you can afford?
So if Johnny can't read, then it makes sense to devote more resources to reading. Then why is arts education even an issue? Because numerous reports have shown that children with some form of arts education perform better than their peers with no arts exposure. To the Philadelphia School District's credit, however, the situation has improved. Since the inception of the School Reform Commission 3 years ago, arts education has become more of a priority. Arts funding has risen for each of the past 3 years, with this year's bump of $2.5 million being the largest increase in at least 40 years. With that additional money, more public schools have musical instruments, theater programs and music teachers are in more high schools, and a partnership with the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Philadelphia Orchestra has launched a new art and music history program. The Philadelphia schools still have a long way to go with arts education, but as school district administrator Dennis Creedon says, the future is bright for the district's 185,000 students.
I think where we are now is one of the most exciting times in the arts that our city has ever seen. We have built relationships with almost every major cultural partner. And when you bring people to a table, for instance, in the arts community, as we're beginning to collaborate with the Philadelphia Arts and Education Partnership, and everyone's at the table, you get a synergy, and people all want to help.
While purportedly beneficial to students' achievement, educating young people in the arts does more than just nurture their minds. There's also the argument for exposing students to art merely for art's sake. Plus, not every child who studies the violin will grow up to perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra. But knowing the basics of music, dance, or painting may ensure these future grown-ups will become art consumers. The very existence of orchestras, opera companies, museums, etc. could depend on it.
Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm. The Philadelphia Sketch Club is America's oldest artist-run organization. Tucked away on a charming side street in Center City, the Sketch Club has been a meeting place for Philadelphia artists for the past 145 years. It's Friday night and dinner is being served in the club's basement. Contained within three converted row homes, the room feels like a 17th century German tavern. Members fondly call this room the Rat's Keller. Personalized beer mugs hang from wooden beams and guests are seated at long tables with plates of comfort food and conversation filling the air. The Rat's Keller seems to be the heart of the club, where the food is served and the friends are made. The sun-filled studio upstairs is the brain, where members sketch. But the dinners and the socialization are as much a part of a tradition as the drawing workshops, and possibly what keeps the club vibrant.
They had meetings, they had parties, they'd have garden parties, cocktail parties.
Betty McDonald is one of the oldest members of the Sketch Club. She's been coming here since she was a child. Her father, Hugh Hutton, was a cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and also a member of the Sketch Club. Although women weren't allowed to be members at the time, she says they were always welcome. In fact, her mom was here each and every Monday night.
They had an etching group here, and there were a lot of women in that. They came every Monday night like it was going to church. Nothing would interfere with that.
The club was founded in 1860 by students from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. At the time, Philadelphia was home to a number of newspapers and publishing houses, all of which needed illustrators, but the academy didn't offer such classes. The men would come here and sketch, network, and dine.
Lunches were served here every day because advertising agencies and the freelancers and the illustrators, they pretty much operated in this community, and they would come here for lunch.
Picturing Thomas Aikens, N.C. Wyeth, and Maxfield Parrish breaking bread and talking shop is not difficult in this cozy space. It's likely, with the exception of the skylights in the gallery studio upstairs, that not much has changed. Thomas Aikens introduced life drawing to the club in the 1870s, and this is still a highlight for many members. Bob Jackson is a sprightly 72-year-old with twinkling eyes and a soft smile. A retired full-time professional artist, he has rejuvenated the tradition of members coming together for food and drink before going upstairs to work. The second Wednesday of each month, Jackson makes dinner for people attending a life model workshop.
And it's worked out very well. This has become a very friendly, homely group. They enjoy the meal, I enjoy cooking, and they bring the wine. And we don't get intoxicated or anything because we've got to go upstairs and draw. And that's the fun of it. And it becomes really like a family group. What happens here is that we don't consider ourselves a school. We teach on request.
Which is also in keeping with the tradition of the club. After all, it's a place to make art, not to be told how to make art.
The way classes work, the model poses for 20 minutes and then has a 10-minute break. You could hear a pin drop while the model's posing. And as soon as you get the break, then people get up, look at each other's work, talk amongst themselves, and become a family.
These workshops are offered 6 days a week, and in addition to life drawing, the club also offers printmaking. Workshops are open to non-members for a small fee. And as member Alan Clawen says, it's nice to have a place to meet with fellow artists.
Being an artist, for the most part, is very solitary occupation. You do your work, you're in your studio, and you have to get a reaction to what you're doing. I mean, everybody likes praise from an art critic, but praise and constructive criticism from your fellow artist is very important.
In addition to dinners, lectures, and workshops, the Philadelphia Sketch Club also has frequent exhibitions featuring the work of both members and non-members. In hopes of keeping the tradition of the Sketch Club going for another 145 years, they also invite students and other young artists to events and lectures, where the fledgling and the seasoned artists get together to draw, share ideas, and, of course, break bread. An official celebration of the club's 145th year occurred earlier this month, and an exhibition commemorating the anniversary runs through December 4th. Art for All Seasons includes work by students of the Moore College of Art and Design and members of the Senior Arts Initiative. For more information on the Sketch Club and anything else featured on our program, head to our website, www.wrti.org. And if you have any comments about the program, you can email us, arts@wrti.org. Now it's time for our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com. Although Benjamin Franklin extinguished political fires in France, back home he put out real flames, but not by wielding buckets, although he did, no doubt, haul some river water in his day. In 1736, in Franklin's typical civic-minded style, he founded the first volunteer fire company so that neighborhood bucket brigades could better protect his beloved Philadelphia. Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis visits Fireman's Hall in the old headquarters of Engine No. 8, which preserves and continues this part of Franklin's legacy.
Of all the images that pop into your head when you hear the name Benjamin Franklin, a guy wearing a fire hat is probably not the most prominent. But at least one artist, Charles Washington Smith, portrayed him that way in 1850. And if you head down a cobbled alley off 2nd Street to Fireman's Hall, you can see the portrait along with historic engines, buckets, axes, hats, and other artifacts that show and tell the story of American firefighting. At first thought, the subject of firefighting can seem both simple and utterly unfathomable. People have been throwing water on flames since the first fire flared out of control. But how many of us really understand what it means to have a job where braving burning buildings is just another day at the office? A visit to Fireman's Hall allows us to step behind the scenes of this real-life adventure. But as Franklin was aware, and as Fireman's Hall makes clear, firefighting is more than water and courage, although you do need plenty of both. The museum is housed in a fire station, formerly the home of Engine Company No. 8, and staffed by real firefighters. Visitors can wander through the two-story firehouse, where exhibits interweave tales of firefighting function, ceremony, and culture. Firefighter Henry McGee, the curator of Fireman's Hall, says it was rough battling blazes in Franklin's day.
If you figure that you're doing everything with almost four-wheel push carts, almost like a bathtub, with really no directional mechanism with hoses or anything like that, the water was provided by bucket brigade. Everybody had to own buckets. Somebody had to ring the bell and warn the people that there was a fire. So I'm sure it was very hectic. Organization's the key. That's where he steps up to the plate and takes care of things.
The early buckets were made of leather. The first engines were wooden carts from which water had to be pumped by hand. The hall has several examples, the earliest, a 1730 Richard Newsom sidestroke engine. McGee explains how the hand pumpers worked.
Depending on the size of the hand engine and depending on how many men could be on the sides to help stroke it up and down, and also the availability of water coming in from the river, as long as the pumper was kept full, and as long as the men were able to pump back and forth, they were able to keep the stream going into the building.
Through the years, firefighting continued to adapt as the city grew both up and out. Engines got bigger, ladders longer, and hoses more sophisticated. The bigger the engine, the more muscle was needed to operate it. Firefighter McGee says the large double-deck end pumper needed 40 men, 20 at a time, working two-minute shifts. In the 1850s, the steam engine came along. As railroads reached into the countryside, steam engines transformed the business of fighting fires in the city, as McGee describes.
Steamers were wonderful engines. They had a fire in them, of course, and as long as you kept coal burning and had a sufficient water supply, they would pump all day long.
Fire trucks are either engines, which carry water to extinguish fire, or ladder trucks, which rescue people. The front of a fire station is called the apparatus room. Here in the apparatus room of Fireman's Hall, We can walk among an assortment of black and red engines and ladder trucks, including an 1896 hand-cranked ladder truck with a tiller on the end, a 1907 horse-drawn coal-fired steam engine, and a 1926 motorized, still-functioning America La France engine, complete with bell and siren. On the wall is an early telephone, which was used occasionally by neighbors from Alfred's Alley. Also, there is an alarm box and what was called the Gamewell Joker system, which from 1857 to as late as the early 1970s received signals about fires called in from street box alarms. The Joker box, although there's nothing really funny about its function, punches out numbers on a ticker tape that identify the box and street location of each blaze, as firefighter Manuel Gonzalez explains to a visitor.
Every fire station had this, so they know what when it was their turn to go.
7355. 7355. That's the box for here. Yeah, the box. It rings the amount of numbers on the box. This steam engine was pulled by three horses, and they knew when it was their turn by that noise right there. They knew when it was time to go. They were ready to go.
Above us, a man clings to a fire pole that stretches from the first floor to the second, although the holes in the ceiling are now boarded up, and the man is, well, a mannequin. Turns out fire poles, however cool they seem, are not the best way to get from one floor to another, and today's firefighters, like Leon Phipps, use the stairs.
Yeah, there's very few firehouses that have poles now. Very few. And I've been here 24 years, and I've never slid down a pole. Guys were breaking their ankles, so they more or less phased them out.
On the second floor, we see a section of an old wooden water main, the kind first laid in 1799. We walk through a replica of a cabin of a fireboat and look at photos, badges, hats, horns, and other memorabilia, as well as an old net that looks sort of like a trampoline. Nets, says Fireman Phipps, have gone the way of fire poles, retired from active duty as too treacherous.
The nets took about 14 people to hold. And ladder companies carried the nets, and there's just not enough guys to hold them. It was dangerous for the people that were jumping and the people that were holding it. If too few guys are holding it and somebody jumps in it, either you're going to drop it and they're still going to get hurt or you're going to break your arms.
Reminding us of just how perilous this job is a stained glass memorial under which are inscribed the names of Philadelphia firefighters killed in action from 1791 to the present. Sobering reminders, perhaps, of Franklin's wisdom when he wrote, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," urging that the best way to fight fire is to prevent it. Fireman's Hall continues Ben Franklin's tradition of raising public awareness of fire safety. Of all of Benjamin Franklin's contributions, there are few that so practically enrich and even save lives. Think about that the next time you pull over to allow a glistening, squealing red truck to pass as it continues Franklin's inextinguishable legacy.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on Fireman's Hall is available at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for this week. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Catherine Blodgett, Charles Gagnon, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.